I kind of liken most of those physiological monitors to a jet ski, in that you ride a jet ski for maybe a half an hour and it is a freaking rodeo of awesome. And then it's like, yeah, this is the same over and over and over. I'm not interested anymore. I felt that way with heart rate monitors. But using a heart rate monitor to not make sure that you're going hard enough, but to more likely make sure you're going easy enough, that's brilliant.
Today's guest on the Catalyst 360 podcast is Dr. Brent Ruby, director of the Montana Center for Work Physiology and Exercise Metabolism. What that actually means is he specializes in studying free-range humans, not in the lab like most researchers, but in the wild, where real life is happening. This has involved chasing fire crews up and down mountains and trailing ultra athletes through Badwater along the Race Across America and in various Ironman's events for 25 plus years. Today, we'll dig into the latest research and what it means, not only for extreme athletes, but for each one of us as we traverse this thing called life. Thank you for joining us here on the Catalyst 360 podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Brad Cooper, CEO of Catalyst Coaching 360, and I'm grateful to have you join us today. With all you have going on in your life, we really appreciate you spending a few minutes with us. For those of you who may be considering pursuing your MBHWSC-approved coach certification, either to start a new career or perhaps to expand your toolbox as a physical therapist, physician, counselor, or other related role, Catalyst Coaching Institute has been consistently recognized as one of the nation's top certification programs and might be worth a look. It's a big decision. We get that. So please, if you'd like to talk it through, please reach out to Susanna directly, our Chief Learning Officer, and she's happy to set up some time to talk through all your questions and walk you through the process. Her email is susanna@catalystcoaching360.com or 720-339-4292. You can also access all the details on our Institute site at catalystcoachinginstitute.com. And now, it's time to heat things up with Dr. Brent Ruby on the latest episode of the Catalyst 360 podcast. Dr. Ruby, great to have you here. Got the chance to hear you speak live, two, 3 months ago. Knew you had to be on the show. This is awesome to have you. Thanks for coming.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Your research, you focused on this term of free-range humans. I love that, especially in the context of everything that's happening right now. Can you explain to our listeners what in the heck you mean by that, and how it differs from the typical lab-based studies that are being done?
Yeah, well, long ago in the 1900s, when I first came to Montana, I had this crazy idea to try to sell the concept to a funding agency that it wasn't enough to just do controlled studies in the lab. We wanted to do some pretty aggressive studies in not just outside of the lab, but like way outside of the lab, like not even connected, not like we're just playing in the sandbox outdoors. This was with fire crews in completely remote, unscripted scenarios. And the reviewer comments came back and they're like, oh, brother, there's no way this is going to work. This is it's an absurd idea, da, da, da. But it did work. And then ever since then, I've just always had this fascination with that's where the real action happens. That's where the battles are fought, the fires are fought, and the medals are won. Long distance away from an ergometer or a treadmill. And so we use the lab as sort of our grounding place. I mean, that's our home base where we can really hone in on mechanistic stuff or questions, but we're unapologetic about trying to always find new and unique field settings to study humans in, because that's, you really get it's like MTV unplugged. It's just cooler.
Yeah.
And you just hear it a different way. You get to witness it a different way. And the outcomes are less predictable, but more fulfilling, I suppose.
Well, and more, I'm going to use the word accurate. That's not true because we're getting a lot more variability in there too. But
yeah,
but you talk about the difference between internal and external validity and validity, and maybe that plays a role here. Can you introduce our listeners to those concepts and why it matters that what they're reading in the literature?
Yeah.
Be careful what you're doing with that.
Oh yeah. It's a battle. That's the constant researcher that cares, that there is a constant battle and push and pull between external and internal validity. Internal validity is what most people obsess about. And that is, to what extent is my study controlled so that I can project the outcomes to the independent variable that I'm interested in. Like if you're interested in sport drink A versus water, that's your independent variable. And so you could test that in a very controlled way in the lab and come up with the conclusion that sport drink A is better, helps you ride longer on a cyclergometer in the lab under those controlled situations. External validity is, okay, sweet, nice results, but how can we take, to what degree are those results applicable to somebody that's riding their bike on the lava fields of Kona,
right,
in the Ironman? It's not a perfect transition. And so oftentimes you'll do a lab study where everything's controlled and you just say, oh, this works for every situation. And then you take it out into the real world and there are too many extraneous variables, the weather, the climate, or the altitude, the whatever,
all the competition, of those things. The pace that you've got to go at because where your competition is, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. So all of those things start to assume more of a front runner position. And then what you were hoping to say was awesome becomes considerably less awesome.
Well, I remember we had Chris McCormick, the 2-time Ironman world champion, on, I think it was last year sometime, and he's famous for having had everything perfectly dialed in, and then he gets out there on the lava fields and he's like, forget it. And he just went back to his Coke. He went back to his Coke and he went back to, you know, whatever. It seems like, I don't know, is I don't want to say your message, but is your methodology spreading? Are more and more researchers doing this? Because I'm seeing the opposite. You're hearing, because it makes a great headline in the podcast, somebody finds a little tiny study done with mice, and then they extrapolate that to you fill in the blank, and it makes big headlines. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, this is the perfect thing. And you're saying, no. Like, let's start with humans, and then let's put them where they're actually living, competing, surviving, et cetera, et cetera. Is this methodology expanding? Or are you still not a one-man show, but are you kind of still out there on an island?
Yeah, I think we really are. And the only reason I think or I know that is because the reviewer comments have not become less hostile over the years and less judgmental and whatever. I mean, I review so many papers every year, and my strategy for reviewing them is to provide a constructive criticism, not try to annihilate somebody for whatever reason. And we've had lots of back and forth with journals because they didn't like the methodology because it was something that we did in the field. Mm. That's nothing new. That's nothing new to this kind of science. But I think it's way easier for a supplement company, for example, because they're world freaking famous for funding small scale studies where they control virtually everything. And at the end of the day, even if the p-value is not statistically significant, there's almost always a line in those papers that say supplement whatever may provide advantageous whatever for sport and exercise performance. And it's like, since when did that become the same thing as significance? Like, it's not. But I do think that it gives people a little bit more I don't know. They don't have to work as hard to do a lab-based study, in my opinion, because I've done hundreds of both. Yeah. So
let's explain to our non-academics what happens in this review process. So I'll give the short version. You can fill in the gaps. You spend 3 years on a study. You present it to a journal. You get back generally anonymous. Many reviewers are now putting their names on it, which I love seeing, but generally anonymous feedback on your study and why it is or isn't a good fit for the journal. And here are the changes that would be necessary to make that happen. So that's the quick overview. Fill in the gaps in between there, and especially some of the things unique to yours, where you're out there in the free range studies and they're being reviewed by people that have never done a free range study in their life.
Yep. That's about right. I mean, you as the author or the research team, you typically suggest reviewers to the journal who would be a good person to review this. And we always pick that based on not who we know, but who's done work in that area. So if we were going to do a study where we're going to present some data on whatever, something in Ironman, water turnover in Ironman, I would look for people that have done studies with Ironman athletes, not just in the lab, but in the field. But sometimes you can't find them. Yeah. And so you find others that are focused more maybe on the lab-based work, and they don't understand the logistics of how difficult it is to test people in the field. And so there's a little bit of go back and forth, but that's just normal. And oftentimes when you send it to a reviewer, or a reviewer is somewhat new, they tend to be a little bit more edgy, and probably because they're less experienced as a researcher, and they don't fully understand that it's really hard to do these studies. I just don't think there's any room for condescension in the review process. The only time I've had issues with that is if the reviewer or the author, if I'm reviewing a paper, or if somebody's reviewing one of ours, if the reviewer or the author is completely unfamiliar with the related literature and they don't give any recognition to some of that literature, I have a problem with that. Sure. Because that's just, they're avoiding it. And that's not right. If somebody was going to do a paper on wildland fire physiology and they didn't cite any of our papers, which we've done more than pretty much anybody else in the world, there would be a problem with that, because they're not representing the literature as a whole. And that's one of the biggest things. It's easy to sort of cherry pick papers that support your cause, but you need to do it. You need to do justice to the rest of the breadth of the literature out there.
Yeah.
But
all right, let's shift gears just a little bit. You've been quoted as saying we are put together for physical activity. It's ingrained so deeply down to the genes in our muscles that we're pre-programmed to have to do it. It's a requirement. Could you flesh that out for it? I think it was an interview I was listening to as I prepared for this, but I was just like, yeah, but flesh that out for us a little bit. What did you mean by that? It's a requirement.
Well, we're stitched together in such a beautiful way, but at the same time, if we don't take advantage of those physical capabilities, then they start to wane. And when they start to wane long enough, the disease state slips right in. And so there's no question that longevity is a massive function of just physical activity patterns across the lifestyle. And it's always fascinating for me to see why, and having lived through lots of reasons why a human chooses to be physically active. When I think back to when I was a little kid, I chose to be physically active because it was just so much fun to throw a baseball around or hit a baseball or play a pickup game of football or whatever, or just rage around on the recess at school. But now it seems like a lot of physical activity in youth now is all organized. So the only way the child gets access to physical activity is if it's paid for and scheduled and organized, and somebody in a minivan's got to drive them there. And then as you age, if you grow up with only using organized sport as your conduit for physical activity, it might become, I would think it'd be more and more difficult to fit that into your schedule, as opposed to just retaining some semblance of play. It's just so absolutely critical. It's undeniable in the literature that physical activity at all stages of life is the great surgeon. So it provides such protection, and it is the drug of choice that no one wants to take, or that fewer and fewer people want to be prescribed.
And I know this is not a research-based answer necessarily, but what's going on? Like, I understand the busyness and the time constraints and the maybe the situation if you're in a city that doesn't feel safe, but that's not everyone. For the folks that are right. not dealing with those limiters, what's going on?
Oh, geez. If I knew that, I'd be retired. It's kind of the same argument where you see people, no matter where they are in their lifespan, if they have little kids, bigger kids, older kids, growing kids, or they're retired, it always fascinates when people say, "Howie, how you been doing?" And somebody says, "Oh, I'm just so busy."
Yeah.
What does that mean? Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah. So you fill your day with a schedule. Sweet. Everybody does that. Everybody's got the same number of hours. We're all working with the same clock, but there are a lot of restrictions that a work schedule or a family schedule may superimpose on your day to day. And it all just becomes a matter of what you prioritize and what you put forward. When our kids were really busy with activities or whatever, I remember taking them to cross country meets or track meets or whatever. And instead of sitting around all day in the stands, I would go for a run myself.
Totally.
And then come back and be that much better off. So just trying to fit it in. When I was racing Ironman and my kids were little, it was really difficult to be gone for large chunks at a time, but it was really easy for me to go for a long run and take one of them with me, and they rode a bike next to me. Awesome. And then you get enormous, awesome conversation along the way. And it's also pretty awesome to be on a 20-mile run when your daughter is riding with you and she bonks so horribly bad that you then get to revive her with candy and soda and then explain what's going on.
So, yeah, absolutely. I love that. with the activity side that were put together for XYZ, okay, the athlete, the person that's consistent with their workouts, they get that. What about for the person that's listening that says, you know, I'm real good with my eating plan. I've been really working on mindfulness or spending time reading or whatever it is. I just don't like exercise. What is your message for that person that on a if we say global health and wellness scale, they're focused on some good things, but activity just is not one of them. Is it? I don't know. Any tips out there?
Man, I think a lot of people, when they think about exercise or we think about I got to become more physically active, what automatically jumps into their head is a gym-like environment, a membership, exercise bikes, other weird exercise equipment that try to simulate any number of odd movements, or a treadmill or whatever. They just automatically go to that when it's like, it could be a lot easier than that. There's where we live here in Missoula. I mean, I can be on any trail almost unlimited within about 5 minutes. And if somebody was really struggling with, gosh, I really want to get physically active, my schedule will allow it, but I just can't do it. How do I motivate myself? I'd be like, okay, step one, download a bunch of live Bruce Springsteen onto your phone. Two, get a border collie or two, and everything will fall into place.
Yes. As an Aussie dad, you got me. You got me a border collie. No
it
doubt.
It is so, we had two border collies and they were very active, and it was absolutely mandatory to get them out every day. And it was, at first you sort of think, oh, got to get them out, they're going to get dirty. But then as soon as you're out there, it's like all that melts away, and it's like free activity for you, and you get the enjoyment of doing. I it's hard for me to go for a regular hike or a walk without a dog now, because I'm so love that relationship. And that is it just provides constant physical activity. I'll be doing that this afternoon.
Well, and there's some pushback from the emotion researchers, but the joy in that dog, like I just look at our dog, her name is Sky, and I'll just see, and we're out for a run this morning, and I just, oh, how you doing, baby? You having fun? So
it's wonderful.
So everybody, you heard it here, get a dog and that'll fix all of your issues. All right. So I want to dive into this 21-day overtraining study, because I read it and I looked through some of the comments about it, and then I have probably quoted it to 10 people, and I was just looking at it last week. I love this concept. So let me summarize some of what I pulled out of it, and you can tell me where I missed the mark. You took these folks out, 21 days, you crushed them, like 400% on average. It ranged from 220 to 600 or something percent increase in their workouts. And you then looked for both biometric and subjective responses to overtraining. And pretty much they weren't there. And one of your fascinating conclusions was, yes, but we got rid of family stress, school stress, cooking dinner for yourself, financial issues, traffic, like everything. So stress as a whole, and if I'm on the right track here, this is a huge message for people. It's not the workout, it's not the work, it's the everything. So what did I miss? What do you want to add to that? What else did you learn? Talk us through what else happened with that study, because I loved it.
Yeah, I could send you the YouTube link for, we took a film student with us during that study, and we shot a little 40-minute documentary. Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, we included the link to the podcast.
It's a really fun project, but that took a long time to plan, obviously, and we worked with a wide range of folks to help us map the whole route out and everything. But basically we took riders, 10 riders, very good riders, between probably no less than like a Cat 3 rider, or some of them had histories as a really good age group. Okay. Triathlete, some were mountain bike. It was a wide range of folks, but 10 solid riders. And we took them from Missoula down to Colorado and back through a variety of routes. Average miles, probably 100 miles a day on average, every third day. And this is sort of when, not when power meters first came out, but when they became more accessible.
Okay.
This was when the power tap hub system became available. So we bought a bunch of those, and we used those, and they worked awesome. But the sensor capabilities now is a lot better. Sure. with Strava, with Garmin, with the different power meter options, but nonetheless, they were still quite good. So every third day we would start the day with their breakfast, and then we would introduce them to the course. And it was just, the course was just a point to point stretch that was long enough to accommodate everybody's variation in performance capabilities. But it was a 1 hour time trial, hard as you can go. We called it the hour of power every third day. And what we were interested in is simply average heart rate, average power. And then we kept track of that. That was our performance metric. The problem with a lot of sort of theoretical overtraining studies is, unless there's a decrement in performance, they're not overtraining. The markers that might be associated with overtraining have got to be associated with a drop in performance at the same time. Otherwise, it's not valid. And so there, the only times we saw a slight decrease in power capability was when we were on our farthest out where our turnaround point was, which was near Walden, Colorado. And that's because the altitude was quite high. Yes. Compared to the vast majority of the other segments of the ride, but they put in about 2,100 miles in 21 days, and max tests on the front end, on the back end, and in the middle, muscle samples before and after the rides on those different time points, lots of saliva samples, urine samples, body weight measures, of course the performance metrics. Yeah, so we showed periodic presence, or like you'd see a crop of, you'd see some things go up, like their resting heart rate or their heart rate in the morning during a moderate activity like bench stepping, or a salivary marker would be a little bit higher one day. But it wasn't consistent and it wasn't widespread, and their performance, their power just was rock solid. If anything, it started to drift upward in terms of capability.
Wow.
So,
well, for anybody who has not done one of those hour of power tests, or a power level test, or a time trial, a lot of different names for them. I mean, it's like racing every 3 days. It is everything you've got. And to think they didn't see a decrease over 21 days, seven times doing those tests, is quite surprising. Were you surprised? Yeah. Was it different than what you thought you were going to see?
We thought we were going to break them down.
Yeah.
Yeah. We really thought that they would fall apart. And it was just the opposite of that. And the crazy thing, and we don't have a measure of any of these psychometric or sort of emotional or psychological impacts, but the joy among the group was unaffected. You put 10 people together, and then your support team and your researchers, there's going to be some conflict here and there.
Of course.
We had a little bit of that, but oh my gosh, the absolute hilarity and the joking and the fun was incredible. It did not wane. And I mean, they'd ride 100, sometimes 120 miles that day, bad conditions, wind or whatever, flat after flat after whatever, mechanical. And then we finished the day, and then it was just sitting around joking about the ride or what. It was so much fun. I don't think we'll ever be able to do another magic study like that one. But yeah, it was, Dan, that was a long time ago. That was
2010. Whew.
Yeah, well, it was published in 2010. Oh, I think the data was, right. We collected it in the summer of 2007.
Okay. Wow.
So,
and were there other pieces? So the camaraderie you mentioned, was there a competitive nature that was a buoy for this process? Do you think had you gone another week, they would have gone off a cliff, not literally, but with their biometrics or the subjective ratings? Is there a point where, because so many folks, the endurance athletes listening, love going to these training camps and, you know, we're going to do 4 days of all out, and your body can usually tolerate that. But did you sense, or looking back, do you think had you gone one more week, two more weeks, or as long as you were eliminating all the other stressors in life, not all of them, but majority of them, could they have sustained this another 3 weeks?
I think they could have at least another 1 or 2 weeks, but the only way they would have done that is at the front end, if they knew it was going to be that long.
Yes.
Like if we came back into Missoula and said, oh, guess what? We have another week.
Yeah.
And especially if the course changed every day, but it was an out and back. So we went down the way we went, and then we followed the exact same route on the way back. And so the scenery was similar, just in the opposite direction. And I think that was a little less interesting than the first go, because every day was a new ride. Every day was new scenery and a new setting. And I remember one of the reviewers that was frustrated, didn't like the paper. One of the papers was, you should have done this in a more controlled way. You should have done this in the lab. I'm like, oh brother. So we're going to have people ride 100 miles on a stupid trainer every day. Well, back then there wasn't an adequate type of trainer to be able to do that. I mean, I guess theoretically you could set up a bunch of Zwift setups and smart trainers and go now, but it's hard enough to ride 20 miles indoors on one of those than it is. And to think about doing 6 hours a day for 21 days, that's not going to work. So the novelty was starting to wear off towards the end. And I think a lot of that was just because they're like, okay, enough is enough. We've seen, I'm sick of being around all these people. Sure. I need to move back into my regular routine.
I have a life still. But, were there any, did you track race results for these folks that ensuing year? Because I'd be curious, did it just fall off the map where they gave everything that 3 weeks and they had nothing else left? Or was that a launching pad for a best season ever PR type year?
That's a really interesting question. No, we did not. And their schedules were not like, it's not like every one of them had a set race schedule that they were going to jump into that fall. Right. Some people had, in fact, boy, I can't even speculate on that. I'm trying to remember some of the athletes that might have gone on to Ironman events or whatever. But no, we didn't keep track of any of that.
Yeah, I was just curious. And then last question on that study. So you said you gathered the data in 2007, published in 2010. What other insights have you either done yourself or seen in the literature about overtraining that might build on that I think pretty revolutionary groundwork you set there?
Well, there's still always this quest for people to identify markers. Mm-hmm. And because it gives people something to talk about, and it gives scientists that are applied human scientists something to talk about and pitch. And so they talk about, sometimes it gets integrated into like a wearable or something like that. But the real thing that's important is, well, especially as it relates to overtraining, and a lot of triathletes just love the concept of talking about overtraining because it's a talking point.
Sure.
And the person that's listening probably doesn't care. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Oh, I must be overtraining because I'm so tired. Rode 400 miles this week and ran 50 and I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, no one wants to hear about that. Or compare notes with you. But if the marker that is being used in any of these papers, if it goes up, maybe it's just going up because that's not it's not a viable marker of overtraining. It's a viable marker of the training response. And so if I wake up after a hard day of riding, let's say the day before, and I notice my resting heart rate is a little bit higher, I probably wouldn't notice that because I don't obsess about those things. I never really did. So why would I do it now? But let's just say I noticed that's my wearable says you're tired, maybe take it easier or whatever. And it's like, wait a minute, but I feel really freaking good today. And today on my schedule says, do this oriented in performance. And if you say, okay, wearable, screw you, I'm going to just go for it. And you go for it and you really throw down a really nice performance. It means that whatever the measure that the variable's trying to identify might not be a marker, a reliable marker of overtraining. It might just be, you are successfully developing stress, accumulating stress that is the beginnings of training adaptations. And it's going to show itself in this shape or form or in this measure. Now, if you ignore that long enough, then it could become a problem. But there's a big difference between turning a light switch on and it lighting up a room. That's like turning on a training response and it's setting the stage, and versus saying, oh, because the light's on, I should probably rest today. And so it's one of those cautionary tales where science, it's sort of that classic internal validity, external validity thing where science says, oh, watch out, markers of overtraining. And it's like, what does that mean? But if you can't consistently show that the individuals that you're studying are falling apart, meaning that their performance is lower, not just that they're grumpier, but their performance is starting to decay, now you're overtraining. So,
well, I think that's a great reminder for folks, whether it's something super simple, like my device says I didn't sleep very well last night. We know the data on that. You are tireder, even if that's fake data. You are more fatigued during the day when they've done those studies of saying, oh, sorry, Brent, you didn't sleep very well your last night. And you're like, oh, yeah, I guess I am really tired. When you slept the same as you had before, they just adjusted the data in the research. Or the athlete who's looking at HRV or resting heart rate or whatever it might be of looking at it and saying, interesting, maybe jot it down in a journal or something, and then see how you're doing over the next week. Maybe it is important, but maybe it's not. And giving too much validity to data that we're not exactly sure. It's getting better every day.
Yeah.
But it's not there yet.
No, it's never going to be perfect. Some of the studies we have coming up are going to start to use some AI sort of modeling so that we can theoretically develop like a digital twin of an individual and then route that digital twin through a series of stressors and press play and then sort of look at the theoretical outcome. We don't think that that's going to create any groundbreaking it'll be very novel, but nice thing about that is you can do an infinite number of scenarios and you can create an expected variability in all those scenarios. Then you can use that to help you design or inform future studies a lot more, with a lot more clarity going into it. So you can think, oh man, based on the average variability of this measure, we should recruit 12 subjects and let's do a 4-week study because this, when we put the twins through that model, it would suggest this might happen. And so we're going to play with that a little bit as it relates to, heat stress and altitude stress and, some of the work that we've done with the wildland fire crews. So.
Perfect lead in. I was going to ask you about that environmental stress and adapting that and callusing to that. I remember years ago, you and I have both done a million triathlons, and we rented out a hot yoga studio and did a 3-hour ride in there prepping for a race in St. Croix where it's going to be very hot and humid. Yeah. Is that the type of thing you're talking about, or is it even more specific to the area, and how does that apply both to athletes and to firefighters, that callusing effect?
Well, yeah, we were working on finishing a very large scale heat acclimation study. So one of the classic sort of models is how well do humans adapt to the heat and how long does that take and what does that look like and what's the process? How does it spell out? What are the mechanisms? Are they the same in men and women? Our initial findings are that they are not. And so we're working on that project. But yeah, if athletes from the western part of the U.S., like the Northern Rockies or the Rockies and the Northwest in general, if they're hoping to go to Ironman and race well in Kona, well, it's hard to go from this climate to that climate seamlessly.
Yeah.
because if you're not used to the weather or the heat, not only is it going to be very difficult for you to adequately thermoregulate, unfortunately, thanks to your wearables, you're sort of pre-programmed to one or a few intensities. And when you can't hit those targets because you're all of a sudden running in Kona, it's like, damn it, my heart rate is 20% higher. I just feel like crap, whatever, whatever. Well, you're not acclimatized to the environment. So you can turn on a lot of those mechanisms ahead of time, like in the 2 weeks prior, very effectively with specific training in a similar climate. So the last time I did Ironman and Kona in 2010, I was obsessive about getting a lot of time in the heat chamber. So I would just dial the heat chamber up, which the weather in Kona is pretty much the same every day in October or September. And so I'd always dial it up to like 85 degrees X humidity. And the adaptation was absolutely staggering. I mean, I've seen a lot of my own adaptations, but the sweat rate alone probably doubled in that window of time. My ability to onboard carbohydrate sources at the volume that I was hoping to target became seamless. Whereas if you're not used to the environment and you try to eat what you're normally used to eating in an event that's maybe cooler, you will quickly develop GI distress because you're not sending blood to the gut as well. You're trying to send it all out to the skin to help you cool off so you can keep at your power output or run pace or whatever. But yeah, using some of those strategies with focused heat training, especially heat training, is enormously effective.
Did you find anything, or maybe you haven't even looked at this, but I'd be curious of your opinion on it. When they looked at, I think it was Dweck that looked at glucose intake and ego depletion, if you had one group that said, oh, I don't need glucose, I can take this hard task and I can follow it with another hard task. And the other group that had in their mindset more than anything, and you know, she's the growth mindset lady, of, well, you know, I can do this hard thing, but then I need a break and, you know, some food, and then I'll be able to go back and do something else hard. Did you find anything with perspective on heat helping with adaptation? I'm thinking of, we live in Colorado. My wife grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas. We'll go back there twice a year, every year for, you know, the last 30 years. And one of the joys that I would have there is just going out in my shorts, running shoes, and just a washcloth, a dry one when I'd start, not so much when I get back, and just run, you know, go do a 10 miler, super hot, humid. People are like, that's insane. And I just remember that as being a joy. That was fun.
Yeah.
Because it was so different than what we get in Colorado. And yeah. And I just wonder, did you pick up any, or would you surmise there's any perspective elements to the heat adaptation beyond physiological?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I mean,
someone who says, I'll be fine in the heat without putting themselves in a dangerous situation. But someone who says, I'm okay with that, I'm used to that, I enjoy blah, 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 versus the person says, oh my gosh, it's 8 degrees hotter, I'm just going to be in a terrible situation here. And so they don't adapt as well. Have you seen any of that type of response?
Well, if you need to go into it with the mentality that I'm going to an environment that I'm not accustomed to,
yes,
things will feel different. Yes. I might not be able to run as fast and I might have to make adjustments. If you go into it with that mentality, it's a lot healthier than to say, nope, my running pace is always this, I'm going to hit that no matter what. And then you're halfway into the training session, you feel like crap. And then psychologically, it starts to break you down. I think maybe one of the more rewarding things would be to have physiological cues, like, let's just say heart rate. Heart rate would be great with your GPS. Let's take running as an example. So instead of running the pace that you would normally default to for whatever tempo run, sure, or whatever, you have a target of a particular heart rate.
Okay. Okay.
That in your more normal, what you're used to climate, there's a certain one-to-one there. Your pace of this always provides a heart rate of this. Instead of looking at pace, look at the heart rate and you'll realize, oh my gosh, I'm so much slower, 20% slower, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you have the time to do that regularly, like with adequate food, drink, and rest, while you're there, after a few days, you will start to recognize, not just perceptually, but the data will show that you're adapting. And I think that carries with it maybe a more potent motivational, or that's a more potent motivational target than anything else, if you're willing to appreciate that. But a lot of athletes are notoriously impatient. And so they're not willing to wait for those adaptations to what reveal themselves.
What do you mean? I don't know what you're talking about.
They need to pump their brakes, let the physiological poetry play out, and then they just need to listen to that and have evidence of that. That's enormously cool to watch. At least for me, because that's what we study all the time. So it's awesome to see changes. But if athlete goes through a number of those different scenarios, the appreciation for the physical and the perceptual that comes along with it, that those diversity of experiences just helps them adapt to unforeseen obstacles that might occur during race day or whatever. So instead of just training one way all the time, like having things happen in your training, either purposefully or accidentally, that work or don't work, will lead to a lot of changes. I mean, people do that all the time with what they eat and what they wear and what they put on their bike or whatever. And they understand what works and what doesn't work, and they adapt. Well, you can do the same thing with the physiological cues that you get. And you can make educated, logical decisions on how to integrate those into your overall training plan, I suppose.
So two follow-ups on that. Generally, and everyone's different, but generally number of days to adapt. If you've got somebody who is going to be racing in a hot setting, whether that's Kona or Badwater or whatever it might be, is it 3 or 4 days? You need 5 or 6? And again, I realize there's a range.
Five or six. Okay. Yeah, about 5 or 6. I mean, that's just letting it spill out. That is with activity. You're not going to get that if you just go into a sauna.
Right.
If you just say, oh, I'll just spend time in the sauna and get real sweaty, that'll help turn on some of the sweat mechanism, but it won't do everything.
Okay.
And so activity at close to what you anticipate doing in the event that you're trying to target for or ready yourself for, like if you can ride at that intensity or darn close to that, that will make a massive difference in terms of, and 5 days, 6 days, you probably are almost at least 75% there.
Okay, good.
So the longer you go, the better. Sure. From sort of the dietary adaptation part is going to take a little bit longer.
Sure.
But.
And then the heart rate you were mentioning, hey, stop looking at your GPS and let's focus in on heart rate. Is that pretty dependable with the change in heat versus cool, yeah, altitude changes versus low altitude? Can you pretty much depend on, all right, it's always going to be lower at low altitude, it's always going to be lower at cool temperatures. Is that dependable, or are there just all these different variables playing out that you've got to, you just kind of got to flip a coin with that?
All things adjusted for, like, let's say you've got your power meter on your bike and you got a nice flat course and you ride at 200 watts, mm-hmm, and you ride at that for 10 minutes and your heart rate is whatever, 150. Let's say that's at sort of your sea level base. Now you go to 5,000 feet. Nice flat course. Well, it doesn't matter with the power meter, but let's flat course, 200 watts. And now you realize, wait a minute, my heart rate is 160. What's going on here? Well, that's the function of the altitude. If the temperature changes and the sweat, you notice that the sweat rate is much higher, then that will also lead to a higher heart rate, especially as the exercise drags on.
Right.
But yeah, so just recognizing that environment plays a massive role in what, how the body responds and what you need to adjust. That's another thing that's lost in a lot of, let's say, muscle recovery studies, is those are classically done in the lab, all good. You can then say, okay, you've taken this many grams of carbohydrate, that'll be the best you can do to help jumpstart muscle glycogen repair, whatever, replacement. But if the environment changes, that has more of an impact. It can have more of an impact than dialing in the precise number of grams of carbohydrate per hour. So, but sport nutrition folks don't want to talk about environment. They don't want to talk about that. They want to sell you a product that's optimized. But as soon as the environment changes, then the potency of the product changes.
Let's talk about the recovery side of those products. We really lucky. We got Christy Anschweden. I don't know if you crossed paths with her. She wrote the book Good to Go several years ago about all the myths in recovery and workouts and that kind of stuff. You know, whether it's chocolate milk or ice bath or inflatable leg compression pumps, there's so much out there right now. What are some of the ones that make you laugh like you just did? And what are some of the ones that you say, yeah, Brad, I think there's something to that. Maybe it's not quite there yet, but are there a couple that make you laugh heartily? And are there a couple that you think have some nice potential?
Oh, man. Well, we've done a ton of work in that space with a lot of those products. But our focus on recovery is not is the muscle repaired? Mm-hmm. Are you not sore anymore? Our metric of recovery is, can you perform a, let's say, a 20K time trial as well? Or what's the performance measure associated with recovery? And our element of recovery that we've been interested in is muscle glycogen. So a restoration of the powerful carbohydrate fuel within the skeletal muscle. When people say, and again, another classic thing about the supplement industry, anybody can say anything about any product and no one's going to say you can say they're wrong all the time. It doesn't mean that they can't market the crap out of some garbage product. Marketing is king. Science takes a seriously backseat. And then the science that is done to push those products forward, it's a bit questionable at times, but so our metric is muscle glycogen. So if we drain the muscle of muscle glycogen and then we feed them product A, B, C, or D, or we implement strategy A, B, C, or D, at the end of 4 hours, when we take another muscle sample, what's the glycogen look like compared to when we drained it all from the leg? And we have a super effective 90-minute cyclergometer trial that just zaps everything with a series of intervals and everything that we use. So we take a muscle biopsy before and after that. Oftentimes we'll just take it at the end of the ride and show, oh, look, it's nothing. And then we feed them. And then at the end of 4 hours, it's something bigger. It's certainly not recovered all the way to normal, because that's going to take 12 to 24 hours to do. But you can get a really nice picture of how fast it's coming back within that first controlled 4 hours. And in order to go further than that, you'd have to keep them in the lab, control their activity, control what they eat for longer periods of time. That becomes more of a challenge with free range humans. But yeah, so we a long time ago, I started to get really frustrated by the message that was being pushed forward by the world of sport nutrition, because it made it sound like endurance athletes were a lost cause on their own. There's no way they were going to be able to figure out how to recover on their own.
Right.
They needed massive amounts of, they needed to buy particular products. They needed to run around with a graduated cylinder and a scale and a few lectures on how to recover adequately and what products work. And I was so frustrated because instead of making the science accessible to the athlete, it seemed like the field was making it more and more less accessible. And so I had a grad student. I said, I've got a crazy idea for a muscle glycogen recovery study. We're going to walk across the street from campus. We're going to buy menu items off the McDonald's menu, and we're going to compare those in a repeated measure study with the classic products that are widely available in sport nutrition. You could fill in the blank. In the paper, it says exactly what we used. But it was a mixture of bars, drinks, blocks, whatever. And we compared that to breakfast menus off the McDonald's menu and simple lunch menu items and compared them. I mean, the carbohydrate was exactly the same and the fat was exactly the same. And the timing was all the same. And there was zero difference in how the muscle recovered within that 4-hour window. The glycogen went up the same degree. The blood markers looked the same. Most importantly, at the end of that 4 hours, when they climbed their tired asses back onto the ergometer and they went for another 20K time trial, the performance was no different between both of those diets. And oh man, did I get, I heard it and heard it and heard it from reviewers and everybody else. And they, how it was an irresponsible study and this and that and this and that. I'm like, you're missing the point. The reason for choosing McDonald's is not because we were funded by McDonald's. We were not. The secret was we wanted to take something so far away from what is normal or what's considered healthy or normal or smart. And to demonstrate that carbohydrates are carbohydrates, the muscle does not care as long as it gets to them. And so the dietary products that are out there that say, oh, we work with muscle recovery. Well, if it's got carbohydrate in it and you take enough, it's going to work no different than anything else. You could make, you could make a product out of mashed potatoes and it would be awesome. If you could figure out how to make it taste good, you squirt a bag of mashed potatoes down. But it's all the same. But so then we started to branch out from that. And we started to think about the different environments. Like what happens if we have the muscle, or what if we have the individual recover in the heat? Well, that's bad. That slows down muscle recovery.
Okay.
What if we have them recover in the cold and they start shivering? That doesn't seem to affect it in a negative way. Okay. What if we use a 2-leg model and 1 leg? So we deplete the glycogen for both legs with a cycle protocol. We take muscle samples from 1 leg and one from the other leg at the same time. And 1 leg we keep nice and warm, and the other leg just hangs out in the air-conditioned lab. The warm leg does better.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. What if we leave 1 leg in the normal environment and we cool 1 leg with ice packs or whatever? That's bad. That slows it down. Huh. And so it's like, oh my gosh, the best combination in from all those studies seems to be an air-conditioned environment that allows you to take advantage, so not in the heat, and maybe slightly warming the muscle temperature. Well, we had muscle temperature probes in the muscle too during that recovery, so we know. And it was so we played with that. We did do a project with the Normatec pants to see if that would alter glycogen recovery and performance. It didn't have any effect. Now, people might think recovery also means I feel like I've done something to better ready myself for the next day. So if a human given massage does that to you, fine. If you want a robot to rub your legs, then the Normatec pants might feel like they're doing something, but they're not changing muscle levels of anything or even blood levels of anything. They're not changing that. If you have muscle damage, which most cyclists don't get because it's not the right, it's not like squats. The massage part of it is, if you like it and you think it works, great. But from a physiological standpoint, it's not moving things out of the muscle that muscle contraction couldn't otherwise do quite effectively.
Yeah. My theory on those is endurance athletes have such a difficult time sitting still that when you stick on the Normatec pants, you have no choice. You are stuck in one position. And that's
a good point.
That's why
you That's a good better. Point. And it does. I mean, I guess it could warm up the muscles a little bit more. But like they had those on for long periods of time for that 4 hour exercise or that recovery window. And it had zero impact on muscle glycogen.
But your control was also exactly sitting, right?
Yeah, sitting with the pants on, just not operational.
Right.
So, yeah, if you said, OK, instead of that, you just leave the lab and do whatever you want. Yeah, that'd be a different story.
And just to clarify for everyone, he is not saying McDonald's is healthy. He's saying if you're a recovering athlete, the recovery, the reintegration of glycogen into your system is exactly the same, whether you're paying all this money for these specialty products or McDonald's. But I'm not reading your mind, but I think I am. You're not saying, yeah, everybody, I've got this new diet. It's called the McDonald's diet, and it gives great longevity.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that because it's not sustainable.
Exactly.
To be a responsible endurance athlete and recover using only foods from the McDonald's menu.
Or to be
all
a living human being. Exactly.
Right. But we should never try to fool ourselves that sport nutrition is health food because is freaking not even close.
Expensive candy bars. Yeah, exactly.
You think about gels and blocks and stuff, and then you people will gobble that up by the bucket loads, but they completely, no, Halloween candy? No.
Yep.
No way.
Exactly.
McDonald's? No way. I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah.
So you sparked a thought here. I'm just curious your opinion on this. Again, it's such a weird question. You're probably not going to be like, oh yeah, last week we did that study, Brad. But I noticed, you and I were talking offline about endurance athletics, and I enjoy that stuff. And I've noticed that if I do a hard, let's say a time trial session on my bike, and I turn around and do a tempo run or some intervals less than 24 hours. So let's say it's Tuesday at 10, I do that tempo ride, and then Wednesday morning at 6 a.m., I'm out on the track or the tempo run. I have a pretty good session. If I wait more than 24 hours, I don't. And I don't know if there's something in there with the delayed onset muscle soreness, which generally kicks in at 24 to 48 hours. And so it's all subjective in my head of I'm like, well, I'm not sore yet, so I'm sure I can have a good workout. Or if you've seen something that, yes, within a window, you can double up. And again, you can't do it too much, just like the McDonald's. You're going to have consequences down the road. But on occasion, you can put those back-to-backs and get away with it. Have you seen anything along those lines? Because I've noticed that over the years that once a week I could pop in a sub 24 hour second very high intensity session, and generally it would go very well. But if I waited 36 hours, it didn't go as well.
Huh. I'm not familiar with anything that's looked at the timing of that. And I mean, it's for triathletes, I guess if you were talking triathletes, the opportunity for delayed onset muscle soreness for a well-trained or reasonably trained triathlete is pretty small.
Yeah.
They're not going to get a lot of it unless they decide to run downhill.
Right.
Or they decide to start integrating heavy weight into their, anything that has that eccentric trauma is going to create it. But at that point, if you're running that much, it's going to be difficult to get delayed onset muscle soreness from just another run. And so it's hard to say what mechanisms like could align themselves to allow you to feel better at 24 hours versus 36. It could be just a function of sort of the diurnal changes that we would expect throughout a 24-hour cycle, or it could be that's what either accidentally or physiologically that's you've had enough experience with that being the good formula that anything away from that formula that becomes a little less familiar. And so you maybe there's something in the back of your mind that says, oh, darn it, I'm outside of the 24. Right. But I can relate to a lot of those same feelings. But one thing I think athletes in general, especially endurance athletes, are notoriously bad at is reeling themselves in as opposed to going too hard. There's great magic, undeniable magic in how fun it feels to be fresh and run good this far below your threshold.
Right.
That feels awesome.
Unbelievable.
But it doesn't do anything for your threshold. So instead of feel awesome for 45 minutes or an hour, and then the next day, you're just a little bit too tired to do those intervals that are this far above the threshold, it'd be better to back off and be this far below the threshold so that tomorrow you can be this high above the threshold. Right. And that's where the great magic is. It just seems like when you take especially males and you push them out the door every time, every time they want to run right at that threshold. And we're all at fault for that. I do that all the time. And then when I'm done, I'm like, I feel great. I'm like, yep. But guess what? That didn't do anything to move the needle forward. And so a concentrated effort of just backing off and then readying yourself for the next big day, that's going to start to push you forward. But it's so difficult to be, what's the word? Just patient and not feel like every workout's got to feel like a workout.
Well, what's the old saying? The difference between the pro and the top amateur is, or the age grouper, is the pros go harder on their hard days and easier on their easy days.
Yeah.
And the top age groupers, middle of the packers, they go too hard on their easy days and too easy on their hard days.
Yep.
And if you can remember that's, which one's which, you'll get glorious results.
Yeah, and planning that out and keeping yourself accountable is the only way to do that, because it's too easy to fall into the trap of, I'm feeling good, I might as well just ramp it up just ever so slightly instead of looking ahead at workouts 3, 4, and 5 that week, recognizing that number 4 is the secret weapon. Yeah. I want to do everything I can so that I do number 4 really, really well.
Yeah.
And that I, the only time I've been really successful at following that is when I have a very concentrated training plan that has macro cycles and micro cycles all built in. And usually somebody else has done the designing of that. And I've just tweaked it a little bit, but it's on the spreadsheet. Right. I can look forward 3 days down the line and see and plan. And that's that to be disciplined and follow that. I've never been able to be disciplined and follow that unless it's on a spreadsheet and I've planned it out.
Yeah.
If I just go day to day, unless I'm not feeling great, I'll probably go too hard. But it matters less to me now. I mean, if I were to ever re-enter the world of competition, it would change. But
right. Yeah. You're staying healthy now. Brent, this has been fun. Well, I've got one more question for you. I've held you over longer than I told you out of the gate. So thank you for sticking with us. I'm just curious, a lot of technological developments, continuous blood pressure monitors, continuous lactate monitors, as you look out on the horizon, as people are sending stuff to you, what do you see? What gets you a little excited? Like, oh, you know what, in the next, I don't know if it's 18 months or 3 years, but Brad, this is coming. And keep your eye out for it. Are there any of those types of devices that you're getting pretty excited about? Maybe they're out there, but they're not working like they should or could.
Yeah.
And they will. Or you're seeing, you know, I'm seeing some stuff about this coming out that people are going to be excited about.
Mm. It's fascinating because I've grown up with my world of work sort of alongside measures of heart rate.
Yeah.
And years ago, when the first Polar heart rate monitor just came out, everyone was thinking they were the greatest thing ever. And I kind of liken most of those physiological monitors to a jet ski, in that you ride a jet ski for maybe a half an hour and it is a freaking rodeo of awesome. And then it's like, yeah, this is the same over and over and over. I'm not interested anymore. I felt that way with heart rate monitors. So, but using a heart rate monitor to not make sure that you're going hard enough, but to more likely make sure you're going easy enough, that's brilliant. Using a heart rate monitor in a race scenario to keep you controlled would be good, especially if you're used to that in some of those focused training sessions. Using a heart rate monitor in different environments to help signal readiness within that environment. There are some temperature sensors. They're not the most awesome, but they're starting to get better, that are integrated onto a chest strap heart rate monitor. I don't know how the company got away with calling themselves Core, because you don't put it in your body like a rectal thermometer. That would be hard to market, even if it was Bluetooth. But that, in combination with heart rate, can give enormous insight into how you're acclimatizing to the hotter temperatures, which could be really advantageous. Lactate analyzers, if they come online, that's going to be a little bit more sensitive than heart rate measures during like intervals. But most often, an athlete's perception, especially if they're a decent runner on a track, they can do a pretty good job without a lactate analyzer telling them what they're doing. And unfortunately, none of these wearables are without the gimmick factor that is really what propels them forward, is that the gimmick and the theoretical nature of what it might provide is going to drive it forward more than the potential for physiological change. But continuous glucose monitoring might become a really amazing thing. There's a lot of variability in interstitial glucose measures, and that's not the same as blood. But if you had real-time glucose measures throughout a long ride like Ironman or Race Across America or whatever, and algorithms that would forecast what you need to do for where you want to be, that could be pretty powerful, I think. It's just really, really hard to beat the impact that the GPS and the power meters have brought to the table. All the other physiological wearables that are out there for sleep and for this and for that, they pale in comparison to the benefits of those other two, because those are absolutes.
Right.
And you can use those very objectively to organize your training strategies. And I mean, that's like, there, to me, those were more as significant as like converting the bicycle wheel from square to round. Wow. They made such a difference, especially power meters. Yeah. But I would really like to see more real-time metrics in events, that so that the transmission, the capture and the transmission of the data during events to make the event more exciting to watch from a spectator. It's more like Formula One, where you've got all this data streaming in. Like if we had data streaming in from for all the Ironman athletes out there in the pros, and you could see at any one time their real-time speed, their real-time power output, their heart rate, their core temperature, their skin temperature. I mean, now it becomes a little bit more exciting to pay attention to.
Yeah, no, I'm even thinking the free throw shooter in the NBA championship, seeing what his heart rate is doing as he steps up there. Or does Steph Curry always have a heart rate of 30 no matter what he's doing? You know, you got all these. So, yes, absolutely. Doc, I appreciate it. This is great stuff. Doing good work. Important.
It was fun. Super fun.
Keep it up.
Super fun chatting with you. Yep. Right on. I'll keep you posted on any new developments.
That sounds great. Sounds great. Appreciate it. Good stuff, Brent. I got a chance to hear him live when he was doing a lecture here in Colorado, and knew he'd be a fun one for you to hear from. If you're an employer, EAP, or wellness service provider looking to offer the very best in coaching to those you serve, Catalyst Coaching 360 is the solution. Catalyst focuses exclusively on coaching, their area of expertise since 2007, the same year the iPhone was first released. You no longer use a BlackBerry as a phone. Why continue to settle for old school coaching models? Catalyst doesn't just provide coaching. Catalyst is coaching, and it can be easily integrated into any program or platform. If you'd like to discuss details, please reach out anytime. Results at catalystcoaching360.com or visit the website catalystcoaching360.com. And now it's time to be that catalyst. This is Catalyst Coaching 360's Dr. Brad Cooper. Make it a great rest of your week, and I'll speak with you soon on the next episode of the Catalyst 360 podcast, or maybe over on the YouTube coaching channel.